Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the political fallout in France from the massacre of journalists and policemen that has French President Hollande calling for a national unity rally on Sunday, from which the leader of the far-right National Front has been excluded, much to Marine Le Pen's annoyance, although in the pages of Charlie Hebdo, she and her party were regularly described as a clique of racist and fascist thugs. Philippe Malliere, a professor of French and European politics at University College London, whose main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy, joins us to discuss how French political leaders will resist taking the bait, as the Bush-Cheney administration did when extremists tried to drive a wedge between Muslims and the West. Then we will speak with Dennis Kelleher, the president and chief executive officer of the Wall Street watchdog Better Markets, Inc., which has been described as a constant thorn in the side of Wall Street. He joins us to discuss the latest brazen attempt by the new Republican House to pay back their Wall Street donors by gutting what is left of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act so that bankers can reward themselves bonuses based on having a two-year reprieve from unloading their riskiest holdings known as collateralized loan obligations. We will look into the unusual defeat of this gift to Wall Street and how and when the Republicans and some Democrats will try again to do Wall Street's bidding. Then finally, we will examine comparisons between the Great Society presidency of Lyndon Johnson and the Obama presidency, where in both cases it appears that at the end of the day, Congress determines the fate of the presidency. Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and author of the new book just out, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society, joins us to discuss why, when Clinton and Obama enjoyed Democratic control of the House and Senate, they were unable to get through a fraction of the legislation that LBJ was able to get passed. And joining us now is Philippe Malliere, who's a professor of French and European politics at University College London. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philippe Malliere.
Hello.
And as things stand now, there's a manhunt on, a massive manhunt on, involving 88,000 French police and military, and apparently the suspects from the massacre at the Charlie Hebdo, where eight journalists and two police and a guard were killed. That is now centering on a small town in the northeast of Paris. One has to be a little careful about quoting the latest news. Just yesterday, I quoted a report from NBC News that said that one of the suspects had been killed, the young man, and the other two had been captured. And, of course, it turns out that the younger suspect had turned himself in, and the other two are still, as far as we know, on the run. But with that caveat, Philippe, what's your sense of how this is going to play in terms of French politics, given that the anti-immigration National Front Party won 25% of the vote in the most recent elections in May?
Well, I think, first of all, it's the tragic events of yesterday. It's a catastrophe for not only France, but I think Europe and beyond it. I think it's absolutely unbelievable that two heavily armed men could get into a building and just killed, you know, defenseless people, notably targeting cartoonists, and just because they had exercised, you know, the freedom of thought and expression, having drawn cartoons which were not to their liking. That's exactly what happened. I should add that Charlie Hebdo is an institution in France, whether you like it or not. Everyone knows about it. It's a very, very well-known, very old satirical publication, and the You cited the five cartoonists. Of course, there are 12 people in all, and we should all remember them, but the five of them were extremely well-known people, you know, and so that's a big shock. I think how it's going to now play down, I think it's we shall see soon, but I think, first of all, the reaction of the public seems to be positive in a sense that there's been a large gatherings of people across France, not only Paris, but, you know, a very large crowds gathering to pay tribute to the 12 people who were assassinated. obviously everyone condemned, including, we should say it, but yes, the Muslim population, Muslim authorities, imams, and simple, you know, citizens. France, of course, has the largest Muslim population in Western Europe by far. So that's a very sensitive issue. So everyone condemned, everyone is absolutely shocked, under shock. But of course, now the next issue, and I think the testing one, the big one, is how will the political class, and I use the terminology very loose, very general, very abstract one, political class, how will they act and react to it? Of course, for the time being, it's national unity, which President Hollande called for. But I think you could see already a few cracks in this facade, notably, obviously, as you would expect, the far right and Marine Le Pen's National Front having already suggested or alluded to, you know, the so-called multicultural fabric of France. Was a problem and was the responsible for that. But also it goes beyond parties in France. There are a number of columnists in the media, people in showbiz, who hold the view that, you know, yes, indeed, the sort of ethnic mixity of France is too much, and the French identity is now becoming, you know, a bit uncertain, and there's in fact a man who is constantly in the media. His name is Eric Zemmour, who published a bestseller, over 500,000 copies sold in a few weeks, just to say that, talking about the big replacement, meaning, you know, because of Muslim demography, in a few years' time, there will be as many, if not more, Muslim people in France than Christians or people of any other religion. Of course, that's a complete fabrication. It's a myth. There's only 5 to 6 million Muslim people. The French population is over 65 million. But still, you know, you have this sort of reaction of people. It goes beyond party. And, of course, people are under shock, so there's a lot of respect, of course. No one will, at the moment, start saying that the Muslims, by and large, are responsible for that. But that remains to be seen whether things will stay like that. And again, it will depend very much on how politicians, people in the media behave.
And again, I'm speaking with Philippe Mallier, who's a professor of French and European politics at University College London. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. And Philippe, the brothers, Sharif and Saeed Kouachi, when they carried out their massacre, they called out in the offices of Charlie Hebdo, they called out the names of their targets. And they did speak to one female cartoonist whose life they spared and told her that they represented Al-Qaeda. And here, of course, in the United States, we know from 9/11 that it was pretty clear that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden were trying to drive a wedge between Muslims and the West. And unfortunately, the Bush-Cheney administration obliged in many ways by their foolish invasion of Iraq, which sort of in many ways proved bin Laden's point. So I take it we can expect a more nuanced response from Hollande. Am I right in that?
We shall see. I think so. Hopefully so. I think yes. I think experience shows that, notably in the U.S. and under the Bush administration, that then it was easy and it was absolutely silly to fall into Al-Qaeda's trap, which is actually, yes, let's wage war against us, if you will, because that's the best way, in fact, to stir up the international war, so to speak, between the Muslims on the one hand and the West, which isn't at this time what the very large majority of Muslim people living in France and Europe want. I think every Muslim I know around me is absolutely appalled by those atrocities. So of course that's a political motivation, and to a very nefarious political motivation, I think Western powers must keep their calm and act rationally and good in the interest of their people, and not do what Bush did a few years ago. So I don't think there will be such mistake made on the part of the French or any European nation. However, what could happen is a further stigmatization of the Muslim population in France, which has been stigmatized, to be fair, over the past years. You know, regarding them as potential, you know, terrorists, probably the sort of strengthening of so-called anti-terrorist laws could be also at stake. We have a socialist government, but frankly, it's a very Blairite type of government, like Tony Blair in the UK a few years ago, very sort of right wing of social democracy. The Prime Minister Manuel Valls is a hardliner on law and order issues. So again, we shall see how things evolve. I think the best antidote to that will be the reaction of the French people themselves, civil society. As you know, there's evidence of that today and yesterday. People unite and people say no to any form of terrorism, you know, state terrorism against this Al-Qaeda or whatever form of terrorism. Then I think the worst will have been avoided. But there are, as I said earlier, there are people in French society, like any society, who really want to really exploit the situation for political and for very bad political objectives.
Well, Philippe Malliot, one of the suspects, Sherif Kouachi, apparently was involved in recruiting or organizing recruits to go to fight in Iraq starting in 2005 to kill Americans. And in 2008, he was put on trial and sentenced to 3 years, and the sentence was... he only served 18 months, and he's apparently been on the police radar. So here in the United States, of course, after 9/11, they passed the Patriot Act and other measures. And I think from the American perspective, a lot of counterterrorist analysts are more or less suggesting that somehow the French are pretty lax on this, given the record of one of these killers.
They might argue that. They may have a point, but... yes, you can always argue afterward that they were lax. It seems that this man who clearly had a background, you know, in terrorist training, spent time with a view to fighting in Iraq, also Syria, I understand, that's what they were saying tonight on French TV, spent time in prison. So yes, probably it was out of the radar, surprisingly, more recently. But again, you know, there were measures taken, like there were the building of Charlie Hebdo was guarded. The worst which could happen now is a kind of a national quarrel, so to speak, you know, between French people, a kind of divide along ethnic, racial lines, which is not part of the French tradition. France is a republic. France is not a Catholic country. Officially, it's a secular country. It's a part of its constitution to be secular. So everyone has a chance, no, whatever your religious, ethnic background, everyone is regarded as French before the law, and it's very important. So anyone coming in the national debate with a view to explaining that the real French are those who are of Christian faith and white and so on, it's a complete fallacy and myth. You know, French, it's a melting pot, the same way as the U.S., France. And it's a very old one indeed. So I think there's that. Let's believe in our values in France. Let's keep calm. Of course, let's make sure that, whoever intends to commit such atrocities be arrested and punished. But let's keep calm. You know, it's not representative. What happened is absolutely not representative of the intentions and the ideas of the Muslim population. That's why it's so important on the part of those who are not Muslim to not regard people of Muslim faith as potential terrorists or enemies.
Well, what I think is strikingly similar about this case in Paris, Philippe Malliot, is the comparisons with what happened with the Boston bombing here in the United States, in the sense that these are sort of, you know, reckless amateurs, if you will, conducting terrorist attacks. The Boston terrorists almost did the same thing. They robbed a gas station when they were on the run. And in terms of the abilities of the intelligence services and all the civil rights issues that relate to that, the Russian authorities, the intelligence authorities, alerted American intelligence authorities about one of the bombers, the older brother. So it does seem that you can have the best counterterrorism regimes in the world, and still these kind of amateurs can wreak havoc. Do you see a similarity there?
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. I think it seems as if the two criminals who killed 12 innocents in France yesterday are themselves amateurs, as you call them. In a sense, it's almost ironic. It's a complete tragic act. But when you think that they went to the wrong address, they answered the wrong building, first of all, and they simply asked, is it Charlie Hebdo offices here? You see, they couldn't even spot the right building. So that is very amateurish overall. That shows one thing: when you reach that level of amateurism, it shows that you don't have a strong support. You have a strong base. Clearly, if you're people who are professionals, normally get proper support. And I think clearly that's one more reason to put things in perspective. You know, and also I would add one thing is. Yes, there are people who can commit crimes, any kind of crimes in our societies, but unfortunately that's the price to pay, or that's the downside, if you like, of free open societies, which we, I think, all adhere to. We all support to live in a free world where we are free to not only express our views, such as the views of the cartoonists who were killed, whether you like them or not, but I think in a free world, everyone should have a right to express one's views, as long as those views are not, you know, directly, physically harmful to anyone. And that's really tolerance, that's really respect. And in return, you know, other people should be able to express their opposite views. That's the price to pay, to live in free open societies. That's what we believe in, I suppose, in the US and in Europe. I think the worst would be, and that would be, I think, a victory of the terrorists, is that suddenly, and I think there's a tension, fortunately, in our societies about that, and people arguing that the solution to that, again, to fighting a very small number of people, very dangerous, I accept that, but very, very small number of people, to suddenly react and act like them, like savages, you know, enacting the most repressive laws, giving full powers to the judiciary, to the police, to the army, to do anything. And we know what happens then. We know that we will be, the people at large, will pay the price for it one day, because all those anti-terrorist laws are not good for our public liberties. And I think this is something we should really react. And I said it already, is that we should keep calm and reflect upon it before enacting any new laws or before targeting any population, before condemning anyone. I think there are two criminals, two bastards, who killed in cold blood 12 innocents and 12 defenseless people. That's what we should really condemn, and that's we should really, the police should arrest them as soon as possible and punish them most severely. That's what they merit. As for the rest, I think you can't really, on the basis of that, because those guys have referred to Islam, consider that the Muslim population at large has anything to do with it. You might argue, yes, but they did that in the name of Islam. Well, as you know, in the name of democracy, a lot of people, or in the past of socialism, say, people have done very different things and things which were not good either. So, you know, that's the price to pay in society, in free societies. You know, people have different takes on ideas and issues, and where they're not good, let's arrest those people, let's punish them, but let's not scapegoat an entire population because some did something wrong.
Well, just in closing, Philippe Mallier, back to French politics. Marine Le Pen of the National Front, the far-right National Front Party, is complaining that she has not been invited to the unity rally planned on Sunday. And, of course, it's a bit ironic since Charlie Hebdo depicted Le Pen and the National Front as a clique of racist and fascist thugs. So how do you think that's going to work out? Is she going to be a little shamed? Is the far-right going to be a little shamed?
Yeah, she's complaining about that tonight. Frankly, no one is fooled and surprised in France because the National Front was a traditional target of Charlie Hebdo cartoonist. I happen to know a little bit one of the four cartoonists who was killed, Charb, the editor-in-chief, and I know for sure this man was a man whose political ideas were absolutely opposite of Le Pen and her party, and that's why I don't think he would like to know today, where he is now, that Le Pen could join such a rally in support of democracy, freedom of speech, because for him and for his comrades, Le Pen epitomizes exactly the opposite of all that. So I think, in a sense, this is fair. This is about passing political judgment. More than political judgment, it's about passing, you know, being consistent with everyone's actions and positions in the past. Le Pen has always been against that type of publication, and Le Pen has always been someone who's very crudely has been targeting and scapegoating the Muslim population over the years. His father used to do the same. Charlie Hebdo was mocking religion. He was mocking all religions, all main religions, Islam, but also Christianity and Judaism. That's a fact. You know, it's a country of Voltaire. In Voltaire, you can do that. It's a country where to be anti-clerical and to be also to express anti-religious ideas is a possibility. I'm not saying that everyone should agree with that, but it's freedom of speech. It's very important to be able to do that. Le Pen is the opposite of that. So I think, in a sense, just to pay tribute to those who were killed in order to be the cartoonist, I think it's only fair that Le Pen be excluded from such a march.
Well, Philippe Mallier, I thank you so much for joining us here.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Philippe Mallier, who's a professor of French and European politics at University College London. His main publications are about the French Socialist Party, French politics, and European social democracy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the recent failed attempt by the Republicans to reward their Wall Street donors.
Peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for the weather. Each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy gold.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dennis Kelleher, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog that has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. And Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as the Chief Counsel and Senior Leadership Advisor to the Chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Kelleher.
Thanks, Ian. Nice to be with you.
And Dennis, the House looked yesterday like it was poised to pass a bill that would gut important provisions of the Dodd-Frank Act. And surprisingly enough, Democrats were able to stall the bill. So walk us through the mechanics of obviously the Republicans are only a couple of days into their control of the House, and they seem to be moving pretty fast on a lot of fronts.
Well, you're right about that, and unfortunately, it looks like the new Congress is going to end similar to the way, or begin the way the old Congress ended, which is trying to deliver goodies for Wall Street. So the last Congress ended in December, you might remember, with a big fight over the funding bill that had a unrelated provision in it that allowed the four biggest Wall Street banks to not only continue to deal in high-risk derivatives, but to do it in a way where they get the benefit of the taxpayer backstop, so that if they fail again, taxpayers get stuck with the bill. And Wall Street's allies are beginning the new Congress by putting bills on the floor that do the same thing, but in different ways. So yesterday there was a bill on the House floor that had a bunch of different provisions that was really a Wall Street deregulation bill, pure and simple. It was kind of complex, it had a bunch of provisions, but that's what it was. And it was deceptively entitled, which is the new MO of Wall Street and its political allies, to put these misleading titles. It was called Promoting Job Creation and Reducing Small Business Burdens Act, which was laughably fraudulent because it created loopholes in the Volcker Rule and in other derivatives regulation that we put in place to prevent Wall Street from crashing the economy again. But the outcome was a little bit different. 146 House members voted against it, led by Leader Pelosi, along with the chairman of the committee, Maxine Waters, and Keith Ellison from Minnesota, who did a great job of getting the message out that notwithstanding the misleading label and the spin in PR, that this was pure and simple a Wall Street deregulation bill that was more about Wall Street bonuses than anything else and wouldn't be creating any jobs. And so the result was the Republicans and Wall Street allies were handed a pretty significant defeat because the bill wasn't passed by the House yesterday.
And what was the role of the House Minority Whip, Steny Hoyer? He was expected to sort of help out the Republicans here. Did he do the right thing, shall we say?
Well, I think that, you know, there were a number of people that were on the wrong side of these issues. I think the more important thing to focus on is not just Leader Pelosi, but President Obama himself weighed in. I think it was Treasury Secretary Jack Lew who announced yesterday that the president would veto the bill even if it was passed. So the president weighed in and said, look, we are not going to let Wall Street's allies take down financial reform, which is essentially layers of protection that we're trying to put in place between Wall Street and Main Street to prevent Wall Street from crashing the global economy again and wrecking our economy as they did last time. And so we passed this law, as you know, financial reform, to prevent them from doing that. And what Wall Street and its allies are doing are trying to chip away at that law. And what was important about yesterday is the president stood up publicly through his Treasury Secretary and said, we're not going to let Wall Street do it. The minority leader now in the House, Nancy Pelosi, she said the same thing, went to the floor very strong, put a line in the sand, we're not going to do it. The chairman of the Financial Services Committee in the House, Maxine Waters, and the chairman of the subcommittee, Keith Ellison, all of whom worked this hard, along with a bunch of outside groups, including Better Markets and others, to rip the fraudulent packaging off these bills, which had nothing to do with job creation and nothing to do with reducing burdens on small business. It had everything to do with deregulating Wall Street and paying back Wall Street for other campaign contributions. And that message got out, and 146 members of the House voted against it, prevented its passage, sent the Republicans and Wall Street's allies back to the drawing board to figure out how they're going to try and deliver for Wall Street while trying to trick Main Street.
So nevertheless, Dennis, the vote was 276 to 146. So to the average listener, they're saying, well, how come this went down with the Republicans having such a margin?
Good question. You know, most Americans are too busy, with worrying about their jobs and their families and enjoying life than to worry about kind of the technical, arcane, and sometimes insane world of Washington, D.C. But majority rule, which one thinks happens in a democracy, is a sometimes thing in Washington, D.C., both in the House and the Senate. And so what Wall Street's allies were so confident that they could get this bill passed with a supermajority that they actually tried to move the bill quickly under special rules that required a two-thirds vote of the House. And normally, the majority in the House, in this case, it's the Republicans, it's called moving a bill through the suspension calendar. Normally, you don't do that unless you're confident, and quite confident, that you've got the votes for the supermajority, and it moves lickety-split through the House of Representatives and then over to the Senate. And it was under those rules that the leadership of the House tried to move this Wall Street deregulation bill. And that's why you could defeat it even if you didn't get a majority. But you're right, Ian, that the bill did get a majority. So the House Republicans and Wall Street's allies could come back, and they probably will come back and try and do it again under a different procedural path, which only requires a majority vote. But that may happen, and in fact, the majority vote may prevail. But it's nonetheless important, I think, for people to remember and focus that Wall Street and its allies can be beat, but what we have to do is have transparency and attention focused on what's really going on. And part of the cynical ploy of Wall Street and its allies is to do things in a way that the American public and voters don't know what they're doing, and even more importantly, don't know that they're delivering for Wall Street. So they mislabel these bills. It's fraudulent, some of the titles of these bills, and it's designed so that voters and the public don't know what they're really voting on, or they smuggle it into what's called a must-pass bill, which they did in December, and actually they're even doing now with what's called the TRIA bill, the Terrorism Insurance Bill, which has a little sweetheart special deal for the financial industry in there too. But they do that as a cynical ploy so that both the public doesn't know, and more importantly, that the public cannot hold them accountable for delivering for Wall Street. And so what the people have to do is make sure that their representatives in Congress and the administration know that they do not want Wall Street being deregulated. They do not want Wall Street policing itself, and they want their representatives to vote on these bills as what's called a standalone, so that the American public can know who's voting for Wall Street deregulation and who isn't. And that's a problem we're having right now, is that the whole template or MO of Wall Street and its allies is to make sure nobody knows who is actually delivering for Wall Street.
So why is it then, Dennis Kelleher, that the president folded on the last raid on a financial reform that took place just at the end of the last Congress, where they essentially now go back to the pre-2008 crash situation where the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, is now responsible, is going to be left holding the bag in risky derivative trading. And that was in many ways, the very cause of the 2008 crash. And if that didn't get people's attention, I don't know what else does. And it certainly got Nancy Pelosi's attention, but apparently she got overruled by the White House. So how come the White House folded on that one, but they've stepped up to the plate to stop the next evisceration of Dodd-Frank?
Hey, you know, it's a good question, but I think it's just a little bit unfair to say that the administration folded on it. The problem that was presented in December on the funding bill was a problem that we're going to see this year, and that relates to must-pass legislation. And this goes to show how incredibly shameless and cynical Wall Street and its allies are. So you have a bill in December, the funding bill called the Cromnibus, that funds defense, it funds homeland security, it funds education, it funds, for example, epidemic research at the National Institutes for Health. And stuck into that bill was this special deregulation provision to allow Wall Street to both recklessly gamble with derivatives and to stick the American people with the bill if their bets go wrong. And so what it shows is Wall Street is prioritizing its special interest above every other interest in this country, and it's indefensible. The problem that's faced by President Obama and others in a case like that is, as distasteful and unacceptable as a particular provision like this might be, the bigger issue is, do you veto a bill which stops the funding for the government, would have the effect of shutting down the government? And when you look at the overall package, the decision was made by the administration, and I may disagree, others could disagree, but it was not an unreasonable decision to say, I'm not going to veto the whole bill and prevent the funding of the government just because of this bad provision, even though I wouldn't vote for that provision or I wouldn't accept that if I could look at that alone. And that's one of the problems we have, because the MO, as I said, of Wall Street and its allies is to stick this stuff into must-pass legislation, which they did in December, or put it in legislation like was voted on yesterday in a way that the American people don't really see what they're doing, both because it's fraudulently labeled and then it's talked about in a misleading way. And we have another example right now with the what's called TRIA, which is going to probably be on the Senate floor this afternoon. And TRIA is terrorism insurance. And it highlights how incredibly cynical and shameful Wall Street and its allies are. Because what you had, terrorism insurance comes out of the 9/11 attacks on this country. And because of those attacks, construction in this country over terrorism risk was grinding to a halt. So the government, as a national policy, in response to the 9/11 attacks, basically subsidizes catastrophic insurance so that major construction and events can happen in this country which have a major public benefit. That's what terrorism risk insurance is about. And yet here we have, in that bill, considered a must-passed bill, we have another little sweetheart provision put in for derivatives dealers. And that's probably going to pass too. And so the problem isn't with what happens when the White House votes to accept or signs a bill like that. The problem is the cynical, shameful, indefensible nature that Wall Street and its allies put their special interest provisions above the interest of the country, including, for example, interest in terrorism insurance in the event, God forbid, of another terrorist attack, or above the interest of funding the Defense Department or funding, epidemic research and every other thing that's important. None of that matters to the Wall Street lobbyists and allies. They were willing in December to shut down the government and not fund anything if they didn't get their rollback of that Volcker Rule provision on derivatives. And the same thing we're going to see now on terrorism risk insurance. And by putting it in must-pass bills, you essentially put elected officials between a rock and a hard place that almost guarantees Wall Street getting its special interest provisions in addition to getting major national legislation done. And that's what has to stop. That cynical ploy, which is the MO that we're going to see repeated over and over again, that the American people have to say that their elected officials have to stop being held hostage to the special interest provisions on Wall Street.
So given that in the Cromnibus bill that we talked about that just passed at the end of this last 113th Congress that the president was forced to sign because of the reasons that you've stated, Dennis Kelleher, and it turns out that the rider in the Cromnibus bill was literally dictated to Kansas Republican Congressman Kevin Yoder by Citibank, and word for word, it was inserted into the bill. So is there any way to name and shame the congresspeople like that congressman?
It's a very good question, and you're exactly right. The provision in the Cromnibus, the government funding bill in December, the Wall Street special interest provision was written by Citigroup's lobbyists. It wasn't even dictated. It was written and sent to them in an email, which was ultimately discovered by an enterprising reporter and made public. And so the provision was written by Citigroup and was for the benefit of Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America. Those four banks do 93% of all derivatives trading in the United States. So when there's a derivatives deregulation bill like the or provision like there was in the funding bill or yesterday in the bill in the House, what we're talking about is who's delivering for those four big banks. They always like to talk about everything else except for who really benefits. So there is a benefit to naming and shaming, as you say, except the problem is that when you have a fight over a big bill like the funding bill, the provision that relates to Wall Street special interests kind of gets lost in the debate and is obscured in the debate and obscured in the vote. And that is their intent. That's by design by Wall Street's allies and lobbyists and lawyers here in Washington who have perfected this method of disguising both their self-interest in these provisions and giving cover to their political allies who vote for their special interest. So you have all these people saying, oh, I wouldn't have voted for that Wall Street special interest provision, but I didn't want to shut down the government. I wanted to fund defense. I wanted to do this. So I didn't want to vote against the good things just because of that bad thing. And that's what has to stop is that method and that process, which allows these bad provisions that deregulate Wall Street and actually cause increase the threat of another financial crash and another economic calamity, which is what we're trying to prevent here. And the only way to do that is if there's going to be public pressure on public officials, their elected officials, and they respond to phone calls, they respond to letters. The more they get, the more attention on these issues, the less number of the fewer people who will actually vote for them. But people have to stay on their elected officials to say, stop, no more. Don't do it by design and deception. Make them put the bills that benefit Wall Street on the floor as a standalone bill. Make them raise their hand and say, yes or no, I'm going to stand with Wall Street or I'm going to stand against Wall Street. And so the naming and shaming helps, but what really needs to be done is enough people in Congress to stop being held hostage by the, you know, frankly, the wealthy, powerful Wall Street banks, their lawyers, lobbyists, and political allies, which have a stranglehold on Washington, D.C.
Well, just in closing, Dennis Kelleher, given that we dodged this bullet here in the House vote yesterday, where the vote was 276 to 146 to strike down this another effort to chip away at the 2010 Dodd-Frank financial law. You mentioned that the Republicans will have another bite at the apple. I'll just come through with the same attempts on a majority, straightforward majority vote. Given that prospect, then, are there enough Democrats that will step up so that they can't override presidential veto?
I think right now, if that were, decision would have to be made today, is that there would be enough votes to uphold a presidential veto. If the bill that was passed, bill that was defeated yesterday, actually passed and gets to, say it was a majority vote and it got to the Senate and it got out of the Senate with less than 60 votes, which I believe it would, and the president vetoes it as he said he would, I believe that veto would be upheld. And that's a major victory in the current current political environment in Washington. Now, you know, things change from day to day, never mind week to week. So it depends upon how it's packaged and how it's brought up again, probably next week by the Republicans in the House, and then how it's packaged and how it's brought up in the Senate as to what the actual votes are. But I think the president, to his credit, and senior leaderships of the Democratic Party, including, you know, to her credit, Nancy Pelosi and others, it's to their credit that they brought a lot of light and heat on this issue, maximized, or got a tremendous vote against that bill, and really sent a message that we're not going to stand for deregulation of Wall Street. We're not going to stand for threatening the, you know, savings, retirements, jobs, and homes of the American people, which Wall Street just inflicted on this country a few short years ago.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dennis Kelleher.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dennis Kelleher, who's the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. And Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as Chief Counsel and Senior Leadership Advisor to the Chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into comparisons between Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and the Obama presidency.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a regular contributor to CNN.com and Politico, and his books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me again.
And your new book, which of course borrows a phrase from Martin Luther King, The Fierce Urgency of Now, in terms of comparisons between Lyndon Johnson and the current incumbent, Barack Obama, I guess the one thing that's clear is that Congress determines the fate of the presidency.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of comparisons made about the personalities of the two men. Obama's passive. Lyndon Johnson was much more aggressive. Lyndon Johnson loved politics. Obama seems hesitant. But really, what we need to look at is the context in which they worked. Lyndon Johnson had a Congress which by 1964 and 65 was ready to roll. There were huge liberal majorities by 1965 that were ready to pass bills like Medicare, voting rights, with or without him. Whereas Obama, after his first year, has faced a much more difficult congressional situation, a Congress where Republicans, rightward Republicans, have really dominated the institution. And at the same time, Obama doesn't have the same kind of mass liberal movement that existed when Lyndon Johnson was president. So context matters a lot. And certainly in the book on Lyndon Johnson, I found that was a key to his success. And I think it's also one of the problems our current president has faced.
Well, of course, the Democrats and particularly the White House could only dream of having 68 seats in the Senate and 295 seats in the House, both giving them a two-thirds majority.
And it wasn't simply that there were these huge majorities. It comes after an election in 1964 where Johnson trounces Barry Goldwater, who was a right-wing Republican who ran on the idea that Republican conservatism, right-wing conservatism, is a good thing. And he was devastated in a landslide. And so not only were the majorities huge in 1965, but many Republicans were terrified about looking too conservative or looking anything like Barry Goldwater. So they were willing to make deals with the president, willing to pass domestic reform, even if they had their own adjustments to it. So it was a really unique moment that came about when he was president. And I do think many presidents probably envy that.
So, Julian Zelizer, on this 50th anniversary of the Great Society, where movies like Selma are in the theaters and up for the Academy Awards, you can't help feeling that it's almost the opposites is happening now. It's like the dark side of the mirror, that we have a polity that's almost a diametrically opposite in terms of a liberal agenda, a liberal juggernaut, if you will, going through Washington. Now we seem to have a conservative juggernaut.
Well, I think in many respects that's true. Just looking at the years in the 60s seems unbelievable today, not simply in terms of so much working for that brief period, but also the kinds of programs that were passing through Congress. Medicare was a huge initiative that provided insurance to all elderly Americans to pay for hospitals and doctors. Voting rights and civil rights were legislation dealing with the most divisive social issue at the time, which was causing violence in the streets. And the moment in politics was very different than today when the Affordable Health Care Act, which is, by all accounts, a pretty moderate health care reform, caused all kinds of turmoil here in Washington. You could argue that the right now has the kind of organizational infrastructure that liberals enjoyed in that 1964-65 period. And that's also a pretty big difference with where you were. But let me add, what's remarkable, too, is a lot of the programs from the Great Society survive. And it's a good lesson that even if you only have a brief window, policies can last and they could become pretty entrenched in American government. Programs like Medicaid today are seen as pretty much part of the status quo. Even conservatives defended Medicare against the Affordable Health Care Act. And so it's also a good lesson that when you can get that change, it can be enduring.
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a regular contributor to CNN.com and Politico, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. So in terms of lessons that perhaps the Obama administration could learn from Lyndon Johnson, and it may well be too late, one thing that I see as consistent and also consistently puzzling is that when the Democrats get the trifecta, when they have the White House, the Senate, and the Congress in their control, is when they don't get a lot done. It happened to Bill Clinton from 92 to 94. He didn't get a lot done. A lot of the problems came from the Democratic ranks. And the same, you could argue, happened with Obama. He had those 2 years, the first 2 years, and he didn't get enough done. He didn't get enough of a stimulus, and he didn't get a lot of, he said he basically concentrated on the one thing, the Affordable Care Act, which has been the focus of this jihad ever since.
Well, one of the things that I did find remarkable about Lyndon Johnson, which relates to that, is he understood the limits of his power more than anyone. He didn't believe in all the hype about him. He didn't believe all the hype that this was going to be a liberal era in politics. And he had been in Congress for most of his career, and he always said that Congress gets the best of every president eventually. So one of the things he did, he moved really fast, and he put as much out there as possible when the majorities were in place, based on the belief, the correct belief, that that window is going to shut very quickly. He wasn't timid. He didn't say, well, in a couple of years, we're going to be able to do more. He never assumed that. The fierce urgency of now, which comes from the Martin Luther King speech, I think also captures where Johnson was as president, not because he thought he was so powerful, but just the opposite. So I do think it's a lesson and a mistake presidents have made subsequently where they don't use those moments and they don't move with enough speed and vigor.
But when you said a minute ago, Julian Zelizer, that the Republican tacticians are as good, if not better, than the Democrats were back then in the 60s. It seems that if you look at what Karl Rove and Grover Norquist and others have been saying, they seem to understand that if you control the House, you can stymie any president.
No, absolutely. And they've done a very good job growing the House majority through tactics, not simply like fundraising, but working the districting system in the states. And right now we have a situation where while everyone's getting ready for 2016 in the Democratic Party, the House at least is probably going to stay the same. So they've played this long-term game very effectively. And I think ultimately if Democrats are going to regain some political muscle, they're going to have to erode the House majority. Otherwise, you're going to have whoever is president, Elizabeth Warren, Hillary Clinton, they're going to face the same Capitol Hill, and that's a problem. So I think the Democrats haven't done enough good work at trying to change the situation in Congress.
So are we locked into this for some time then, that the only branch that the Democrats have a chance of controlling is the White House?
I think we are right now, and before the Great Society starts passing in 64 and 65, there had been several decades when not a lot of liberal legislation passed. Even though liberalism was more popular then than it was today, even though you had a lot of liberal groups pushing for things, from the end of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency in the 1930s through the early 60s, you have some bills passed. But you don't have any breakthroughs, and you don't have any breakthroughs until finally liberals were able to change the composition of Congress, regardless of who was president. So I think it's a very timely lesson today, and we're not going to have a vastly different situation until Democrats do better work in Congress.
But what happened to the word itself, liberal? It's become a pejorative almost, and frankly, where you have Republicans, I remember during the Mitt Romney presidential primaries where there's that huge field of candidates on television endlessly, each trying to out-conservative the other. It got so crazy that Mitt Romney said, I'm a severe conservative. They wear it on their sleeves. They're proud of it. They proclaim their conservatism endlessly. You never hear liberals doing that. No liberal congressman stands up and says, I'm proud to be a liberal. Have you ever heard of that? lately?
No, you don't hear that very often anymore. There were some exceptions like Ted Kennedy, but you don't really hear much of it. You know, in 1964, Lyndon Johnson ran a presidential campaign where he boasted about being a liberal. He boasted, if you watch the commercials, the television ads, some of them are very negative, like the famous Daisy ad, which was about Barry Goldwater would start a nuclear war if he was president. But a lot of the other ads were about liberalism. They were about why Social Security is important. They were about what the war on poverty was going to accomplish. Johnson loved to say he was liberal. He was believed in liberalism. And many Democrats of that period in Congress did the same. They don't do that anymore. And they still live in that way under the shadow of Ronald Reagan. And it probably hurts them. Ultimately, voters want to be motivated and inspired. And you can't run away from some of the ideals, I think, of your own party and win.
So what explains then the dispirited lack of morale, not just in the Democratic Party itself, but in those that didn't show up to vote? And I believe there was a protest on both sides, although the Republicans are better at getting every last one of their people out. The Democrats invariably fail to inspire their natural majority. And my sense is that people are getting weary of this peculiar politics that we have where fewer people vote, but more money is poured in.
I think part of it's the system and part of it's the party. So the system is what you're saying. There's many flaws, deep flaws, with our political system, from campaign finance to the way lobbying works, that Americans see all the time. And I think they lose some confidence and faith, not just in the idea of government doing things, but in the government itself. And so that helps to erode any sense of urgency on voting day. And each party has a problem. For many Democrats right now, the party is not particularly inspiring for some of the reasons we've discussed, not just the frustration with the president, but a kind of lack of vision or principle. And for many Republicans, while some are very excited about a rightward drift of the party, other Republicans are not comfortable where the Tea Party is. So you combine the system and where the parties have moved in the last few decades, and I think many voters just stay home. And that is unfortunate because ultimately that's the driving dynamic in our democracy.
So just in closing then, Julian Zelizer, what do you see as a way for the Democrats to make a comeback? They don't seem to have any programs. They don't have any strategists. They don't seem to have any courage.
I think they're going to have to look back to what Selma is all about, meaning the civil rights movement. I think it's going to start at the bottom up, not the top down. They have to stop looking for a president to fix their party, and they have to stop looking for one or two leaders to provide the roadmap to the future. I think the kind of organization you saw in the 2008 campaign, which really didn't last after that, it needs to be more sustained. It needs to be more ongoing on issues like economic inequality and immigration. You need to rebuild a robust liberal movement if you're going to change the Democratic Party. Whether that will happen, I don't know, but it's a lot of hard grassroots work which made the 1960s, and I think that has to happen again.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's a regular contributor to CNN.com and Politico, and his books include Arsenal of Democracy, The Presidency of George W. Bush, Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.